The BioRevolution Podcast.
Your hosts,
Luise von Stechow
and Andreas Horchler. The BioRevolution Podcast, this time from biohacking to healthcare, the growing pains of the longevity industry. We've been talking about this easy for quite some time, but this time we invited a guest who's very experienced in the field.
Yes, we have Nico Hems with us today, who is a longevity writer, and I actually came across his content because he has a very nuanced view on many of the longevity trends, which are often all hype. So I'm really looking forward to having this discussion with you. Maybe we should also invite someone who's more hyped. Let's see how much hype we'll place in this episode. Nico is also the growth lead of the Berlin-based longevity company Years, and maybe we can get into what you guys are doing there in this episode as well. Publishes the Beyond the Hype newsletter, no need to say anything else about it, and I think hosts the pretty freshly instated podcast Return on Health, which is really worthwhile listening. So we'll link all this in the show notes if people want to learn more.
Good title for the podcast.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Cool.
Very much. Welcome.
Thank you.
Izzy, we, of course, as always, want to start with quotes.
Yes. I will just read one quote today from Frank Lloyd Wright, who said, youth is a quality, not a matter of circumstances. Mm-hmm. I think he's talking about architecture, but I think we can also talk about what that means for human health, because I think there is a little bit of truth in that as well. And I think that also brings us or segues us a little bit into this longevity field where we have a little bit of everything under one umbrella.
Yep,
we have lifestyle, we have wellness, we have beauty, we have biotech, we have pharma, we have tissue regeneration, we have biomarker companies, we have clinics, we have cryopreservation of tissue. So it's quite a mixed bag. So I think what would be great with you today is to try to shed a little bit of light on what we would think are the more science-backed parts of the field and which are more towards the marketing guru side of the field and try to get an idea of what maybe the individual can take away for their own longevity from this, but I think also more of an industry-wide view, where would we place our bets, what is going to work and what not. I mean, and of course, then people have to pay for this episode, I would say around, let's say $10,000 or something. If we give this very important information out to our listeners, we will tell you what works.
Exactly that. Yes.
And I think what I find really interesting, and maybe we can get into that at the end, is this question of who's actually going to pay for all of it. Because I think at the moment, longevity is really a field of self-pay, of consortium models. And why are our healthcare systems so unwilling to pay for prevention? And
many reasons.
How could we incentivize that this could be really,
I think the healthcare system and policymakers should be interested in closing gaps of sickness in old age, for instance. So they should be interested. And still, it's self-paying, as you said. And it's not the ideal world we're in right now.
It is not. And I think this is something that for the society as a whole, but also for the individual, extending the health span would be really important. And maybe we can actually start with that. And in our previous longevity episodes, we have introduced this concept, of course, but I think it's maybe, again, good to stress. I mean, their longevity means a lot of different things, right, to different people. But there is the age span. So we're getting older and older over the last century, decades older. It's almost doubled, I think, the life expectancy, but mainly due to the fact that we don't die that early anymore. There's antibiotics, better sanitation, better drinking water. All these things that just, and better nutrition. So we just live longer on average. But longevity also, and I think that is accepted amongst many people, means living healthy for a longer time, not just living longer, because if we just extend the amount of years that we spent with chronic disease,
the question is
how much do we gain actually?
No fun at all.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, for the, I mean, the healthcare system and for society also a huge socioeconomic cost to say.
It's a burden, yes, absolutely.
And I mean, for the individual as well. So how do we extend that? So I think that's maybe what we want to get into today, but maybe we can start with a personal question. So what actually motivated you to get into this field? Because I think you have a business background, right?
I do have a business background, So it was back when I was 13 years old. I'm pretty tall, I'm
close to being 2 meters. And back then I was pretty, quote unquote, underweight, at a BMI of 17 point something.
Oh my God.
Or 18. So like borderline underweight, and felt pretty uncomfortable in my body. Really wanted to change that. And this is what really got me into, first of all, nutrition, because nutrition is super important to gain weight as well, also in a healthy way, which was my goal back then. But then also strength training, going to the gym. Then I read pretty much all of the books. Podcasts weren't the thing back then. Would have listened to all of the podcasts also, but I only had books. So I read all of the books, looked at some videos, some talks, all of this. This really got me hooked into the topic. Then did my personal trainer certification, all of this stuff, nutrition certification, just because this was my passion. Then gained around like 20 kilos. So I saw that it worked and I felt way happier and way more comfortable in my own body. And then after my A-levels, I thought about, do I want to study biology, nutrition, exercise, physiology? And I thought, I don't know if I can make a living with that, to be honest, back then. Now I would change my mind.
Absolutely.
But back then I thought, okay, let's just study business. My parents did that as well. They are into business. So I thought, okay, let's just study business. And then the switch came doing my master's in Lisbon, where I studied management and data analytics. There I met Miguel, which is now my co-host for Return on Health. And yeah, we've talked about health all the time. Health, longevity, health optimization, also problems, incentives of research, whole lot of different topics. And this is what really got me into the field again. And now I'm 100% hooked. I'm doing my master's in longevity right now at GCLS, Switzerland. First of its kind, which is interesting. Yeah. And I work at a longevity clinic. So now I'm pretty much never doing anything else.
So really that's remarkable. The first European academic program.
It is.
Yeah. Master's program.
In the world, actually.
In the world,
even. Yeah.
I would have thought that in the US you would have quite a bit of those programs yet.
You have similar programs, geoscience, for example, or like healthy aging programs. But it's not necessarily the real longevity. I wouldn't say that, but it's not called longevity.
All right, sure.
Okay. That's maybe the main difference.
Yeah. Oh, really interesting.
How do you tell one thing from the other? In other words, what's the greatest BS in the longevity world right now?
That's insanely hard to answer.
Okay.
I mean, there's so much bullshit out there. Maybe an interesting thing, I listened a couple of days ago in a podcast of a German biohacker. I think the name is Ivan Mike. Let's maybe call him out. That's fair enough. He is deep into biohacking. And then also most people who are deep into biohacking are also deep into peptides. Mm-hmm. And peptides are quite interesting mechanically. And also, for example, insulin is a peptide, GLP-1. So Ozempic is a peptide. So pretty much everyone heard of the word peptides by now. But then there are also different, quote unquote, longevity peptides. They call it like that. I don't know. BPC-157, TB-500, all of them. And Ivan Mike talked about them, and I think it was in a podcast, I don't know, the podcast host asked him, okay, what's about the safety and do we know everything? And the answer was, yeah, we know everything. We know all of the pathways and we know what happens in the body. This is complete BS. I mean, we do know some pathways. This is true, but this doesn't mean that only because we know the pathway in a cell culture, that this is the same in the body. No. I mean, you know as well, because you're a scientist as well, that this, like in most of the cases, it's just not the case. What we see in the cell doesn't always mean, or like most of the cases does not even mean that's the same in the human body.
Yeah, and I mean, we have a number of different cells that do different things. So might be doing one thing in one cell.
Yeah.
I think there was some, I don't know, longevity or biohacking conference in the US where people injected peptides some people died or at least were severely ill.
Yeah,
I think this is what you point out there. This is one of the really difficult factors because we have this huge umbrella of different players and many of them are not regulated. But because it's all, we feel like all of that is the output of pharma. So these are medications and this should be safe because it's science. But I mean, there are different levels of what science has actually validated and whatnot. And of course, I mean, knowing something about a pathway doesn't mean that it's safe to put it into your body. I mean, this is like this. It used to be that people say, yeah, it's all natural. It's good for you. But it's sick. I mean, poisonous mushrooms and snakes are all natural, but they will still kill you. So I think this is,
This is always a problem.
How would you say, how would you identify? Because, I mean, you write a lot about the BS in the field, right? And also about the good applications. I mean, now we're calling out only the bad stuff, but I mean, there's a lot of good stuff as well. But where would you say are the biggest, let's say, red and green flags for it, where you say, like, can you identify from the title already of a study or of an article if it's going to be worthwhile or not? Or do you, how far do you have to get, and where do you see the cues that something might be something that we want to look into deeper and something that we can like completely dismiss maybe?
Yeah, I think the biggest problem isn't like studies itself or only looking at certain studies. It's that influencers on social media, for example, in short form videos or on LinkedIn posts or whatever, they cherry pick studies and point out the one study which actually fits their narrative. Mm-hmm. But then if you look at the whole body of evidence, let's say there are 20 studies, one points into the direction they want or they think is right. And then the 19 other studies, which they don't look at, they tell a completely different story. And if you look at all of the evidence, the story goes obviously in the direction of the 19 studies. So that's one thing, cherry picking studies. That's what a lot of people sadly do. And that's what a lot of people don't recognize, because it's hard to recognize.
It's super hard to recognize.
Here's a study and, I don't know, endothelial dysfunction is the main culprit of cardiovascular disease. It's not LDL cholesterol. Yeah. That's a common one. I mean, maybe it definitely plays a part, that's true, but it doesn't mean that LDL is not part of the puzzle. Exactly.
Eat butter. Only butter.
Yeah, eat only butter, exactly. This is one problem. I mean, you have a bunch of problems. You also have the problem of people using a study, for example, an observational study, epidemiological study, and then bringing causality from it. This is also not really possible. You can see correlation and you can adjust for a ton of things, but there simply isn't causality without like RCTs, Mendelian randomization, meta-analysis of RCTs, all of this. So we need to be more cautious. And like most absolute claims where someone's saying this causes X, most of the time are not true. If you really look at science, it's more like this points into the direction of, or this maybe could lead to potentially. This is more the science speech. So this is also a thing, listeners could take a look at. If you see this, most likely it's just marketing.
Yeah. Does that mean in a nutshell we need more regulation?
Good question.
A pro and con, isn't it a kind of a shaky field, I would say?
Yeah, I think more regulation can help potentially, but then there's also the thing, if what like 1 million people do it, who in the world is like putting the regulation to court, for example? No one will do it. So I don't think there's necessarily any benefit there. I think we just need to educate people better on how to read studies, on what really makes evidence, what's different level of studies, like an RCT is worth more, quote unquote, than an epidemiological study, most of the cases. But then there's also population sizes. If you have a group of 10 people, can't really create causality from that. If you have like 1,000 people randomized controlled study, this is a whole different topic. Then you have meta-analysis, Mendelian randomization. You just need to educate people on these topics so that they can make a better decision from this. And they can look at the post or the wheels or podcast as well, which is also a thing now, and just make their own decision based on that.
I would say for one thing, more regulation could really help, which is the general field of supplements, because I think there the challenge is, I mean, the one thing is that I think many of the supplements per se wouldn't work. But the other problem is that because they're not regulated, you can actually not be very sure they are not undergoing the same control. So you cannot be sure what's in there, which of course is pretty scary in a sense. So there,
we've been joking about this, of course, the people who, you know, digest a handful of supplements early in the morning and then another one at night and poison themselves.
Yeah, I mean, to an extent, you might actually poison your kidneys by taking too many drugs or too many supplements that you don't need, because, I mean, everything that you put into yourself needs to be excreted at some point. So somehow your body needs to deal with it.
Right.
And not everything is beneficial. I mean, it's this too much of a good thing also. I think, for example, taking too many vitamins, even though vitamins per se are probably good for you, but overkilling it on vitamins is probably very bad for you. So, I mean, there needs to be some kind of balance to it. Where would you see like the most interesting directions of the field, more towards the lifestyle optimization, more towards the biomarkers, or more towards really like the therapeutics?
As of right now, definitely lifestyle, because lifestyle has the biggest lever in terms of health span optimization. We have sleep, nutrition, sports, or going to the gym, cardiovascular exercise, as well as strength training, and also mobility. If you have time, most people don't. You need to find your balance. And then also stress management and mental health, which is super undervalued, especially in today's times with our smartphones and short form content. All of that is not really beneficial for our mental health. I think we all know that. So these five pillars are super important and definitely the biggest levers. But then also in terms of prevention, it's always good to do testing to really know, okay, where do I stand today? And then do these lifestyle interventions most of the time, maybe pharmacological interventions, but this should be done by a doctor, definitely. And then lifestyle intervention, and then 1 year after, see where you stand now, and then maybe adjust based on that. But definitely lifestyle is first, always. And then in terms of therapeutics, I mean, there are a lot of interesting new things out there. Even peptides are generally interesting. We just need way, way, way more research on that in humans. Please in humans, not in mice or whatever. GLP-1s are super interesting, especially for severely obese people. There's also now the trend of microdosing GLP-1s.
I have not heard of this.
Yeah, it's new. I also haven't looked too deep into this.
Interesting.
I think for GLP-1s for severely obese people is also really interesting, especially for people who just really can't do it on their own, then most likely it's definitely beneficial. And then also super advanced stuff like TPE, total plasma exchange, plasmapheresis. It's mechanically interesting, and there's some data, really not much, on it that it could make sense. But we just need a ton of more research. And the biggest problem, it costs a ton of money. Even if we have like big RCTs on this and they say, okay, the benefit is enormous, it still costs like 10K. So it's not affordable for most people. So lifestyle first.
Interesting also, of course, that you mentioned GLP-1. I mean, generally this axis of metabolic health of metformin is one of the very recognized mTOR inhibition, rapamycin is among the recognized compounds that are likely to do something. I find it an interesting concept. GLP-1, we know, definitely has benefits and might, I mean, extend healthy lifespan for sure in people with metabolic dysfunction, with obesity. Might also do so in people who have no metabolic dysfunction, TBD. I mean, we don't know yet. I think there was a neurodegenerative trial, the Alzheimer's trial, that didn't read out positive. So that's one thing. But I think in many smaller studies, there were a lot of things, right, that were related to health span, to aging-related diseases where we, I mean, where it did have at least some benefit and, again, needs to be confirmed and maybe cannot be confirmed. But the question would be if we could now, let's say, have enough evidence to say probably we can extend our health span with GLP-1s, with metformin, with rapamycin. I mean, would it be a strategy that people are prescribed, per se, these drugs by their physicians, or that it's even a government-led program to say, like, we want our population to stay healthy, so please inject yourself, or, I mean, if it's an oral version. I find that quite interesting. How would you feel, like, about these kind of, I mean, it's a bit dystopian scenario that I'm painting now, but maybe let's tone it down a little bit and, yeah, preemptively taking this kind of medication if we have the feeling it would extend our health span or lifespan potentially.
Yeah, if we would have more data, that means, like, huge RCTs in healthy people, not only in, like, as of now, like, diabetic people and obese people, but in also healthy people as well. And if this data points towards a direction that it may extend healthy lifespan for whatever reason, doesn't really matter here, then I think potentially makes sense. But there's, again, a huge downside, because for everyone who took GLP-1s already, they know how expensive they are. So I think from a government standpoint, it's super hard to do, because they don't really... Sadly, and that's also a problem we can talk about later again, they don't really have the money to invest in those things, which only have a return on invest long term after 10, 20, 30 years. This is also one of the huge problems with insurances, for example, why they don't pay into prevention, but that's another topic. So I think it's super interesting, but we just need to make it way more affordable for everyone, if it works.
It's an interesting concept. And I think this axis of metabolism, I mean, this, for me, is one of the stronger leads for sure, because, I mean, also there are these fasting experiments in mice and generally, like, metabolically deficient mice, IGF-1, which are small and sad but live long. So I think that's... And they feel cold.
Good example.
But, yeah. But I think there is a lot of evidence pointing in this direction that something might be going on there. So I think this is for sure an interesting lead. Let's see where it leads. And I mean, one has to say, it's of course also GLP-1 has some not so pleasant side effects, like the potential of bone mineral reduction. So I think that would be something to watch out for.
Oh, yeah, definitely. There are always side effects.
Yeah.
You don't get any effect without side effects.
That's true.
The longevity clinics are taking off kind of right now, and definitely going to be a concept of the future.
Yeah.
Can you take us inside those walls a little bit? Is this for the wealthy few? Is this something for Silicon Valley tycoons? Or is it something that will eventually grow into an offering for those who are willing to get their lives better?
Yeah, definitely. Really good question. So, for example, we at Years, our smallest program, which already takes like 5 to 6 hours, has 30 tests and then 90 biomarkers, so it's not really small, costs 1,800 euros. This is the starting point. So I think only from this standpoint on, you can already tell that this is most likely not for everybody, or like definitely not for everybody. This is for people who do have the money to spare, and also for people who are privately insured, because most of the private insurances cover at least parts of the program. Most of the time, also big parts of the program. As of right now, mostly like for people who are rather wealthy and for Silicon Valley tech entrepreneurs, for example, especially the bigger programs, they can cost up to 16,000 euros. Also in the US, here in Germany as well, we just do those programs as well, who are super advanced. But as of right now, sadly, it's only for the richer. You don't necessarily need to be super rich, but richer. And that's the main problem. I mean, we do have some preventative programs in Germany, for example, Checkup 35, which is better than nothing. Don't want to put any blame on this, but it's not really...
It's not the whole thing.
Definitely far from being the whole thing. We have colonoscopies, breast cancer screening, all of this. This is good, but we can do way more. But the main problem is that governments or public insurances, they cannot pay for this, simply because of the reason that they don't have any money to invest in. Same issue here, we also have the governments. Like, they don't have money to spend, which will only have a return in 15, 20 years. I talked to a CEO of a big public health insurance, and this is exactly what they told me. They just don't have the money. They know it works. They know there's an ROI, but they cannot spend it. Like, it's not possible economically.
And they would have midterm benefits from it.
Definitely, and they know it.
Big time.
Yeah. They know it. That's a problem.
There are always these models, right? And even breast cancer screening and even PSA screening are sometimes debated, right?
Yeah, because
the question is, do you catch it early enough to intervene? Yeah. And I think this is what the healthcare system, it's not about catching something early, but catching something in a way where you would then have an intervention that has a measurable output. And I think there, even the really well-tested markers like PSA are sometimes put into question, which I find very interesting. That also brings me to this question about these bigger biomarker panels. I mean, where do you say, because I think not for many of the things, you don't really have a lever to do anything about it, right? You just know something might be amiss, but you might not be able to change anything about it. How do you, because you also mentioned like more the mental health part of it. Do you know the story of one of the Google founders who was married to the 23andMe and founder and found like a variant that would predispose him, I think, to get Parkinson's later on, but you cannot do anything about it.
Yeah.
So how do you, I mean, integrate that? Because I think, I mean, for some people that can also cause a lot of stress, right? Just knowing that you have a predisposition or that you have some markers that are not as they should be, but there is also not really any intervention except for living healthier, what you would anyways hope and try to do.
Definitely. I think the problem is rather in the genetic panels than in the biomarker panels. And biomarker panels, they're also some specific biomarkers who are not really actionable as of now. You have the value and then first of all, you don't really know what this equates to clinically. Is there any change even, if this is out of range? There are some endothelial dysfunction markers, for example, where we don't have yet enough validation to really use them in an effective way. If we have like ApoB, for example, it doesn't really add more value to this. But then there are genetic panels as well. Mm. So for example, ApoE4, which is the Alzheimer gene, if you have one allele, I think it's 4x increased risk. If you have 10 to 12x increased risk, this is scary, really is. And you cannot really do anything about it except like lifestyle interventions, which you are supposed to do anyway. So there's no real value. And I myself, when I was in Berkeley in the US, I did some consumer genetic testing as well, which was really similar to 23andMe. I forgot the name of the company, but pretty much the same thing. And then I got like 900 different things. Some were red, some were yellow, some were green. I was like, what the hell is happening here?
No.
What am I supposed to do with this? And there also is the thing, like you have APOE4, which is causally related to Alzheimer's and medically proven. And then you have like, for example, I had something which was telling me I have knee pain or like a high chance of getting knee pain. And this was based on a mechanistic study.
That
and
this with then, age.
Yeah, exactly. And this stands side to side. So consumers also don't really know the difference. Yeah. One is really validated and one is pretty much just a guess.
Yeah, and this I find this really risky, these kind of things. On the other hand, for these kind of things, there should be a physician involved
who
helps the patient to integrate these outputs. Yeah. But it's really being left alone with this kind of information, and especially if you're not able to, as you say, distinguish what does that mean, I think this can be really bad. I also think that even though I kind of counteracted what I said before, there is something to be said if you know that you have a predisposition for something or even a gene causally related to also like fatal disease like ALS or something.
Yeah.
Maybe it would be also nice to know to live your life in the best possible way for the time that you have. So I think there is something to be said for that as well. You said many of the biomarkers are not actionable, but how realistic do you think working with people who want to change their lifestyle, want to extend their health span, how much does this information motivate them? Because what I find always interesting is that, I mean, there's this very simple correlation of people eating too much sugar and getting diabetes and not stopping to eat so much sugar.
The clearest call to action you could imagine.
Yeah, because you really know there's only one thing you have to do. You don't have to take any medication. Right. You just need to change your lifestyle and you will not get the disease.
Yeah.
And people don't manage to do it. I mean, I'm not blaming people. That is not what I mean. I mean, we have these patterns, right, that are really hard to break. So how do you translate knowledge about a certain biomarker into, an actionable lifestyle change?
Yeah. I mean, I myself obviously don't see patients as I'm not a doctor, but I talk to many doctors and also help obviously a lot of friends, and I do it myself. So this is where the thing I'm saying now comes
from. I think the crucial point is, as you told us in the very beginning, that your journey started when you were 13.
Yeah.
So you are used to it.
Yeah.
For, you know, like ever, right?
Yeah, definitely.
And that's a difference.
Yeah. No, 100%. I think the main difference is, first of all, what you already mentioned, like having a person, best case a doctor, who knows their stuff, best case a doctor who is used to working with clients on extending their healthy lifespan, so who's a prevention expert, let's say it like that. They order the labs and they tell you, okay, this is where you stand, and then, this is important, this is where you could go. Like, for example, in 10 years, if you don't do anything, you will, not 100%, but 60% likely will develop heart disease or diabetes or whatever. But if you do something, your risk reduces dramatically. And I think like those risk numbers are super important. Mm-hmm. There's the ACVD index where you can calculate your 10-year risk. Something like this is important or interesting at least. And then also organ ages, which are not 100% validated yet, but I heard quite a few times that they are a great motivator. If you see that your, I don't know, your heart or your fitness age, whatever that means, doesn't really matter, is like 10 years older than yourself, then you get motivated and like, oh, okay, that's not good. I need to change this now. Mm-hmm. This is also where I think like those biological age tests have value. They are not really that clinically meaningful, but I think they are really good for motivation. Mm-hmm. So I think like having someone guiding you and then having like specific numbers, which you can imagine yourself, like age, like a specific age, and not like, I don't know, ApoB of 0.8. Like, what does that even mean? Mm. Most people don't know. But if they see like your heart age, your vessel age is 40, they know what that means.
But then on the other hand, you have this still, after all those decades, sticking narrative, your fellow hamburger Helmut Schmidt, ex-chancellor, when it comes to smoking, you know, of course everybody knows it's harmful.
Yeah.
But then the diehards would say, look at Helmut Schmidt, he's geared to be 90... five.
Pretty old, yeah. Definitely. Okay. Yeah.
And I met him on an occasion, and really, in 1 hour press conference, he smoked 3 cigarettes, he sniffed tobacco, and he smoked a pipe in 1 hour. You know, it was crazy.
I think health is a stochastic process, and you shift these stochastics in one or the other direction. So, I mean, there are many things that we know are harmful, which is smoking, sunlight exposure, sugar, lack of mobility, different types of toxins, infections, stress, inflammation, all these things we know. And having more of them makes it more likely to develop certain diseases, but it doesn't make it certain. And not doing any of these things also doesn't make it certain that you will not develop disease. You can get cancer even though you had a perfect...
Everything right, you can still get cancer. Yeah.
Exactly. And that is something that I think we also need to take into account, of course, for these types of measures that, I mean, it's not foolproof, right? But at the same time, you shift the balance in the better direction. And I think what's a great payoff, if you live a little bit healthier, you're feeling better in the moment, not only in the future, but eating better, exercising, not being stressed, sleeping well, makes you feel better right now, which I think is a great motivator.
Yeah, definitely.
For me, it's actually the best motivator to not feel exhausted and be on top of things. I think one thing about the people who are going into these longevity clinics, who order these test panels online, who already invest in their own health, I mean, there's also a selection bias, right? Because there's people who are already invested enough in wanting to live healthier. And I can imagine that a lot of these people are already living rather healthy lifestyles in comparison to those who have never heard even of that. How can this be rolled out to a broader part of the population? Because what you said, I mean, it's very expensive to run tests and to treat and to run lifestyle interventions. But what's even more expensive is decades of person years spent in chronic disease, loss of work, care investment that needs to be done by family or outside people. So this adds up to socioeconomic costs of course, far exceed the investment. Said, I mean, we cannot... This is a calculation that you can do on a piece of paper and that will not convince any policymaker. But do you see any like measures? How can this idea of prevention, of health span be brought to the broader public?
Yeah, this is the $1 billion question.
Now, the $1 billion question is the longevity pill for dogs. But
fair. What we are trying to do at YEARS is we are... in the long term, also trying to publish case studies so that we have evidence to show that those preventative measures really equate to long-term healthy lifestyle and to having no diseases in the long run, or like
fewer
diseases. That's a better word. But then also, I mean, there are so many things where we need to have change for that. We need to have insurances who can... public insurances, definitely. That's an important thing. We need to have public insurances who have money to be able to invest long term, which they don't right now. And that money needs to come from the government. We need to change incentives. We need to change a lot of different things. But then also we need to change education itself, because most medical doctors right now, they don't really are trained in prevention. They are mostly trained in sick care, which makes a lot of sense. I wouldn't put blame into this. We need this. Yeah. But they still, we also need physicians in the long run who are trained on prevention and have this mindset of, okay, you are here, you are not at a diseased level yet, but maybe in 5 years you will be looking at your biomarkers and looking at your trends. We need to stop that now. Yeah. Most doctors will not do that because they're also not trained to do that and they don't have time. And then also there's the billing problem. Like, for example, our doctors spend like 1 hour, 1.5 hours with their patients. That's not possible at all with a normal GP, just simply because they cannot bill that much.
Yeah.
They wouldn't be able to make any living with them if they see a patient like 1 hour. It's not possible.
Yeah.
So we also need to change the billing system. There are so many things who need to have changed. I think education is the best thing, because then we can push. Because if we have more medical doctors who have this mindset, okay, prevention is necessary, then they can make a push towards the government, insurances, and this maybe will in the long run equate to change. But yeah, it's a hard one.
Yeah.
Deep one. Closing, Nico, do you have just a short longevity hack for our listeners, viewers?
I think sleeping is the most important thing.
Nice, I love it.
I put so much emphasis on sleeping, maybe sometimes a bit too much, but like having 8 hours of sleep in a cold bedroom, make it dark, make it quiet.
Beautiful. I love it.
1 hour before that, don't go into your phone, all of this stuff. This really helps. It really does. Like, for example, today, this morning, I haven't slept that great. Haven't slept too short.
Yeah.
And I'm tired right now. So my body got used to this quote unquote perfect sleep or good sleep.
Yeah.
This is really a thing more people, especially hardworking people, need to put emphasis on.
8 hours. Your commitment is
absolutely. Yes. Maybe one other question. What's the, since you come across many biohacking trends, what's the most absurd thing you've come across?
I don't know if I can mention this here, but
we can cut it out.
But there are some people who are drinking their urine and they ferment it for a couple of months.
Oh my God.
Because of stem cells.
That's disgusting.
This is quite a weird one, but then also maybe coffee enemas. Weird. I don't know what is happening, that some people just think this is amazing idea.
I really also think that this might be very dangerous to do.
Could be.
Because, the amount of caffeine that you might absorb can, I don't know, I think. Yeah.
This is also why you feel something afterwards.
Yeah, I do believe that you feel something.
Yeah.
I think we have answered all the questions when it comes to longevity, and
we have answered all questions.
All questions, all of them, exactly.
But no, I think there will be many more questions coming up, and I think we will continue talking about this topic, and I mean also looking at many different angles. And
I invite you again.
Yes,
most definitely.
Sounds good.
Yeah, thank you.
Maybe we come visit yours and have a look at what you guys are doing.
Yep.
I think sounds pretty interesting, and I think it's a great model, and I think it would be great if it would be accessible to more people.
We would love that.
Even also known to a bigger part of the population. Yeah. What it always comes down to, and we spoke to different people about it, right, is diet, exercise, and sleep. And I think there's so much you can already do yourself on working on that. But I also have to say that modern life really pushes against getting these things right. So we really have to work also a little bit on our own health as an investment in our future and in the future of our society. So I think it's
thank you, Nico.
Important.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you, Izzy.
Thank you.
This was this edition of the BioRevolution podcast. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back, of course, shortly, and you'll find the liner notes, as always, at
ScienceTales.com, and Tales is T-A-L-E-S.
See you around. Have a good time. Bye-bye.